Welcome once again, fellow biblical explorers. In our last study together, we looked at the first 16 verses of the fourth chapter of the book of Ephesians. In our last study, we did a review of the verses, and we saw that the book of Ephesians can be divided into two separate sections. The first, chapters 1 through 3, dealing with our wealth, and the second, chapters 4 through 6, dealing with our walk. We looked at the first couple of words in the first verse, and we saw that Paul, in view of the great riches that we have in God, listed in the first three chapters, told us and urged us on how we should act as followers of Christ. We discovered that the main idea of chapter 4 is one of unity. Now, as we continue our study in chapter 4, we are going to see what Paul is trying to tell us about unity in the riches of his grace. As we delve into this fourth chapter of Ephesians, we start at verse 1, and we see the facts on unity. Chapter 4, verses 1 through 3 says this: "As a prisoner for the Lord, then, I urge you to live a life worthy of the calling you have received. Be completely humble and gentle, be patient, bearing with one another in love. Make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace." Through this first verse, we see that the first fact on unity is one of grace, part of the riches of his grace. Verse 1 suggests a high and honorable state, a calling, if you will. We are told to live as being worthy of that calling, and how are we to live? Well, verse 2 gives us an idea on the way that a Christian is supposed to live. Paul here is listing character traits. Character traits that would seem to be very becoming: humility, gentleness, patience, love. With all of these character traits, we are to try as hard as we can to keep up the bond of unity through peace. We are to protect the bond of unity. In our last lesson together, we learned that it is our responsibility as Christians to guard, protect, and preserve that unity. And Paul is telling us how we can do it. Paul rarely urged people to do things, but he usually urged people to be a certain way. Watchman Nee, in his book Sit, Walk, and Stand, says this: 8 times in Ephesians the word walk is used. It means literally to walk around, and it's used here figuratively by Paul to mean to deport oneself, to order one's behavior. It brings immediately before us the subject of Christian conduct. How are we going to order our own conduct or behavior? We come again to the character traits that Paul listed in verse 2. Verse 2 says, be completely humble. Well, what does that really mean? Humility, or lowliness, as it is stated in the King James, is a thankful sense of dependence on God. It's the opposite of pride and conceit. The Beacon Bible Commentary states that this stance of humility is that of a man looking upward. The proud man only looks at that which is, or which he thinks to be, below him, and so he loses the elevating influence of that which is higher. David Guzuk says, "A worthy walk before God will be marked by lowliness and gentleness, not a pushy desire to defend our own rights and advance our own agendas." Before Christianity, the word lowliness always had a bad association to it. In the minds of many, it still does, but it is a glorious Christian virtue. It means that we can be happy and content when we are not in control or steering things our way. Matthew Henry says, "By lowliness we are to understand humility, entertaining mean thoughts of ourselves, which is opposed to pride. By meekness, that excellent disposition of soul which makes men unwilling to provoke others, and not easily to be provoked or offended with their infirmities. And it is opposed to angry resentments or peevishness." Verse 2 goes on to mention gentleness. Well, what does that mean? Gentleness or meekness? I've heard it said that meekness is actually power under control. Gentleness or meekness, as it is stated in the King James, means more than modesty or weakness. It is that unresisting, uncomplaining disposition of the mind which enables us to bear without irritation or resentment the faults or injuries of others. Meekness has been called the disposition of the Lamb. David Gusuk goes on to say that we need this disposition of the Lamb. We need this so that the inevitable wrongs that occur between God's people in God's family will not work against God's purpose of bringing all things together in Jesus, illustrated through his current work in the church. Long-suffering has been defined as the spirit that has the power to take revenge, but never does. It is a characteristic of a forgiving and generous heart. I love the words of Matthew Henry when he says, "This implies a patient bearing of injuries without seeking revenge. Forbearing one another in love signifies bearing their infirmities out of a principle of love, and so as not to cease to love them on the account of these. The best Christians have need to bear with one another and make the best of one another, to provoke another's graces and not their passions. We find much in ourselves which is hard to forgive, and therefore we must not think it much if we find that in others which we think hard to forgive them, and yet we must forgive them as we forgive ourselves. Now, without these things, unity cannot be preserved. The first step towards unity is humility. Without this, there will be no meekness or patience or forbearance, and without these, no unity. Pride and passion break the peace and make all the mischief. Humility and meekness restore the peace and keep it." Matthew Henry goes on to say, "Only by pride comes contention. Only by humility comes love. The more lowly-mindedness, the more like-mindedness. We do not walk worthy of the vocation wherewith we are called if we be not meek and lowly of heart. For he by whom we are called, he to whom we are called, was eminent for meekness and lowliness of heart, and has commanded us therein to learn of him." Verse 2 goes on to talk about being patient. What does that really mean? Patience or long-suffering is that enduring spirit which knows how to outlast pain or provocation in a strength learnt only at the Savior's feet. This means having a wide soul, so that we can bear that burdensome neighbor. It brings peace right in the face of provocation. Verse 2 goes on to say, bearing with one another in love. Well, what does that really mean? Well, that's the practical outworking of that patient spirit in which we go on loving and respecting others in spite of their faults and their weaknesses. Now, these character traits that the Apostle Paul has mentioned now in the first couple of verses of chapter 4 have been sometimes called the graces of unity. It's amazing to think that those graces of unity are found in one verse, Ephesians chapter 4, verse 2, "Be completely humble and gentle, be patient, bearing one another in love." What beautiful words from the Apostle Paul as a prisoner for the Lord, urging us to live a life worthy of the calling that we've received. He says in verse 3, "Make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace." David Gusuk, in his commentary on this particular verse, says, "This humble, forgiving attitude towards each other naturally fulfills this gift of the unity of the Spirit." We must endeavor to keep this unity. We do not create it. God never commands us to create unity among believers. He has created it by His Spirit. Our duty is to recognize it and keep it. This is a spiritual unity, not necessarily a structural or a denominational unity. It is evident in the quick fellowship possible among Christians of different races, nationalities, languages, and economic classes. We can understand this unity of the Spirit by understanding what it's not. In a sermon on this text, Charles Spurgeon pointed out some of the things that this text does not say. It does not say to endeavor to maintain the unity of evil, the unity of superstition, or the unity of spiritual tyranny. It does not say endeavoring to keep up your ecclesiastical arrangements for centralization. It does not say endeavoring to keep the uniformity of the Spirit. Guzik goes on to say structural unity can even work against the unity of the Spirit. We can perhaps see a purpose God has in preventing a structural unity of the church right now, to keep misdirected efforts of the church, such as ambitions for political power, from fulfillment. Spurgeon goes on to say, "It is not a desirable thing that all churches should melt into another and become one. For the complete fusion of all churches into one ecclesiastical corporation would inevitably produce another form of popery, since history teaches us that large ecclesiastical bodies grow more or less corrupt as a matter of course. Huge spiritual corporations are, as a whole, the strongholds of tyranny and the refuges of abuse, and it is only a matter of time when they shall break into pieces." Bruce says, "For the church fellowship in which the Gentiles and Jewish believers were united was no mere enrollment on a register of membership. It involved their union with Christ by faith, and therefore their union with each other as fellow members of his body." And Spurgeon goes on to say, "We are confident that this unity is found in Jesus Christ by the Spirit of God. We want unity in the truth of God through the Spirit of God. Let us seek after, let us live near to Christ, for this is the best way of promoting unity. Divisions in churches never begin with those full of love to the Savior." This unity of spirit is brought about by the riches of His grace.